talked about. Okay, thank you. We will move out of public hearing on House Bill 2492 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2193. We're going to ask Jeff Van Valkenburg and Pamela Abernathy to come up. And while they're getting situated, Council, would you give us an overview of the bill, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2192 comes to the committee at the request of the Department of Justice. Currently, ORS Chapter 179, 505, Subsection 9, specifically requires that no written accounts referred to in Subsection 2 of the section, which deals with health care and medical records of the Department of Corrections and the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division, may be used in legal or other proceedings unless the patient voluntarily produces evidence. From the position of the Department of Corrections and the divisions involved and their counsel, this has hindered their ability to respond to legal proceedings or potential legal proceedings. You will find in your packet a copy of the relevant statute, which deals with medical and treatment records or health records in state institutions, which are solely guided by these statutory provisions. The other thing I included, because I think there may be some reference to this, is the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, which deal with hospital records, because I think that there will be some analogies to that.
Thank you, Council, and welcome. And we ask each of you to identify yourself for the record and tell us about the bill and what it does.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Pamela Abernathy. I'm a special counsel to the Attorney General. On my right is Jeff Van Valkenburg, who is present to answer any particular questions you may have relating to the corrections aspect of the bill. On my left is Lila Rathall from Fairview Training Center, who is here to give brief testimony and answer particular questions relating to that aspect of the mental health developmental disabilities portion of the bill, which provides access to patient records in where we need to defend personnel actions taken against staff. But it is my pleasure to give you an overview of the bill and why the Department of Justice supports House Bill 2193 with the proposed amendments.
Can I ask a quick question?
Wait a minute.
We have a dash one set of amendments. We also have an outline of your testimony. Are you supporting the dash one amendments, or are there, when we say dash one, it means HB 2193-1 in the upper right hand corner?
Those are the amendments forwarded to us by Mr. Van Valkenburg.
That's correct.
And I apologize for not noting that.
Thanks. Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Mann.
The current printed bill was originally drafted by the Department of Justice at the request of the Department of Corrections and only related to inmate medical records. The proposed amendments, which you have in 2193-1, expand the scope of the bill to include access by the Department of Justice and risk management to patient medical records maintained by the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division, i.e. patients at Damish, at Oregon State Hospital, at Fairview Training Center. I am here speaking to you because my experience in the Department of Justice has been to defend Fairview Training Center for some 5 or 6 years. And as I pointed out earlier, Mr. Van Valkenburg has experience on the corrections side. The bill is needed because currently we have no access to patient records without the patient's consent to defend Department of Corrections and the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division in litigation or potential litigation initiated by inmates or patients in the care and custody of that division. Nor do we have access to records, even to look at them, to support personnel actions that we've taken against employees for patient abuse. Finally, the state's risk managers have no access to records in order to evaluate and settle claims. The fundamental policy underlying the bill and the proposed amendments is to place the states and its attorneys on equal footing with private attorneys and private health care providers. Right now, in the private sector, if I were a patient at Salem Hospital and I sued Salem Hospital, I sued a physician, for example, the first thing the physician would be to call his or her attorney, I would suspect, get the attorney down to look at the record. If any of you are familiar with medical malpractice cases, you know that we say if it's not in the record, it didn't happen. So the record becomes the principal vehicle by which those cases are defended. The attorney has access and can review the records in order to consult with the physician to say, you're out of line, you better settle, to talk to the other side, or to prepare a defense. Under the current statute, the state's attorneys, assistant attorneys general in the Department of Justice, have no similar access when a claim is filed or when a lawsuit is filed. There are two parts to the bill, one relating to corrections and one relating to mental health. And let me just go into the peculiarities of each because the statutes that are being amended are just a little bit different. The statute that is amended by this bill relating to corrections is ORS 179.495. That prohibits access by attorneys except by court order or if the patient gives consent. And what has happened in the past, then, is in order for us to defend inmates' cases, we've had to go to court and get an order. Now, I'm not here to tell you that the court doesn't routinely grant those orders, but we think that is an unnecessary expenditure. And we also need this bill as a partner, if you will, with the habeas corpus bill, which you heard the Chief Justice and the Attorney General testify about the other day. That's House Bill 2391. I'm not familiar with the intricacies of that bill, but I do understand, and I hope you heard, that part of it was to allow habeas cases to be resolved on summary judgment. Now, without an amendment to ORS 179.495, which we propose here, we won't be able to put those records into evidence on summary judgment without getting a court order.
Let's stop you there. There's at least two questions. Representative Mannix.
I was going to say that my reading of this would be that I don't think you need to worry about the inmate records part of this bill. The one part that we're hearing a little opposition to is the rest of the amendments. And Representative Mason, when he was chair of this committee, used to tell folks that, you know, if we've got parts that we're comfortable with, and I can only speak for this corner that I've been hearing from, a lot of us are pretty comfortable with the original bill, and if we could focus on the rest of that, we could probably move along.
Well, except.
But the chair would like that.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative. I'm unclear about the connection to the habeas corpus bill.
Mr. Chair, as I understand it currently, and perhaps Mr. Van Valkenburg, who has, in fact, that's a good idea. Perhaps Mr. Van Valkenburg, who has experienced
Hello, Mr.
this problem, would like to answer the question directly.
Why don't I address that?
Glad to hear.
Mr. Chair, Section 6 of HB 2391 amends ORS 34.680 in the habeas statutes to provide expressly that supporting evidence in the form of documentation may be used in the defense by the state to establish that the plaintiff has failed to not only state a claim, but to establish his claim. Without access to those records, we cannot provide the motions.
Okay.
Where is that bill now? Did that pass out? It
goes to the full committee on Friday.
Representative Bellman, did that bill, the habeas corpus bill, come out of the crime sub unanimously?
Which day?
Friday. The habeas corpus.
It's done.
It's on its way to full committee, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
I think it came out unanimously. Of course, I'm a good person to ask.
Well, that's why. Okay, thank you. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mannix, let me then address my remarks to the portion of the bill that I'm directly familiar with, which is the portion related to access to patient records. People in Damage, people in Fairview, why do we need those? The current statute prohibits our access as attorneys to those records without first obtaining the voluntary and informed consent of the client or patient in those institutions. In that statute, unlike the current correction statute, there's not even a provision for access by the attorneys for those defendants upon a court order. So the very trial attorneys that are attempting to defend claims brought by patients relating directly to the care and treatment of those patients at Fairview, Damish, Oregon State Hospital, any institution, the very trial attorneys defending those claims are not allowed to see the records until the patient or client puts at issue and in evidence at trial those records. So it's trial by ambush in the classic sense. And what this bill would do is allow access by attorneys for...
Are these plaintiffs not normally deposed? There's no depositions that happen in these cases?
Representative Clark, even if we have the ability to depose these plaintiffs, we have advised our client and unfortunately think we're correct on the law that the rule of civil procedure, which would normally allow for a subpoena duces tecum to be served along with a notice of deposition and allow us access to records through that route, is superseded, if you will, by this specific prohibition in 179.505. There is a specific provision in ORCP for subpoenaing of hospital records. And there's, as counsel pointed out earlier, and I think you have in your packets, there's another ORCP with regard to access to hospital records. Under the old maxim that the specific controls over the general and the extreme prohibition of the statute, we have determined that we cannot use those provisions of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure to access medical records, and that's the problem that we perceive.
Representative Edmonds. I understand your point, your rationale. My question is, this records law is not in, it doesn't really deal with records that are relevant to an action brought by the patient or the client. It just basically deals with records generally.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edmondson, there is no specific restriction as to relevancy in the current language of the proposed amendments.
No. Excuse me. I lost you.
Okay.
The statute as it exists today, 179.505 that we're dealing with here,
yes,
deals with records generally, does not specifically address, or does it specifically address records that may be relevant in a civil action? And what I understand you're trying to make it specific to that by allowing for that disclosure. But as it stands today, it's just a general records law. It's not. Okay, that's what I need to be clarified.
Yeah, let me refer you to subsection. Make sure I find the right subsection for you. My general answer, and I will find a specific statute, is that it refers directly to records even where the care has been put at issue in a civil proceeding.
I think it's subsection 9 of 179.505, which refers directly to records which would be relevant in a civil, judicial, administrative, or other proceeding. And it's that provision which we're presenting to the committee here that is restricting the Department of Justice and these agencies' lawyers from going in and defending these lawsuits. It's that provision which is so restrictive itself and which overrides the general provisions in the ORCP.
Okay. I want to read this, and I may have other questions, but I appreciate your opinion here, and I respect it, but has this been litigated, what this statute means? Do you have any kind of court decision that says that this means that? Because the ORCP, I mean, the general rule is that if you're putting your medical condition at issue to try to recover damages, you have in essence, consented to the disclosure of information regarding your medical condition.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edmondson, we were sued. The direct answer to your question is no. I don't believe there's been Yes, the issue has been litigated. First, let me point out, we have been sued with regard to a violation of the statute. And we settled that lawsuit because we believe that the attorney, the Assistant Attorney General, had violated the statute, had obtained access to the records, and had disclosed those records in violation of the statute in a situation where the patient had put his emotional state of mind at issue. Now, maybe we were wrong, but our best informed judgment was to err on the side of caution and to read this statute restrictively. We do so because of not only the face of the statute, but because the Rule of Civil Procedure 55, which allows normal lawyers to subpoena hospital records, has a provision in it that says...
Never been called normal before.
That means I'm abnormal.
You said it.
The ORCP 55H2 has a provision in it that says if disclosure of such records, referring to hospital records, is restricted by law, the requirements of such law must be met. So we felt we had to read those two in pari materia, as we say.
So tell us how the department has been defending these lawsuits all these years, the mental health lawsuits.
Well, Mr. Chair, with some difficulty. We have instances where department lawyers have subpoenaed the records and had them arrive in boxes in the middle of trial. We have instances where, in personnel actions, we simply were not allowed to use the records themselves as evidence that the abuse did in fact occur and that our personnel action was therefore legitimate. Now, in some instances, we have been able to obtain the patient or client's consent. And obviously, if we could do that 100% of the time, no such statute would be necessary. But I think it's fair to say that many guardians may wonder why records of a patient are needed, especially with regard to need to access in a personnel action. It's more clear where the patient, him or herself, has put the medical care at issue. But if in a personnel action we were to go to a client and say, we are defending Mr. X, or we are defending the actions of Fairview Training Center because of abuse, we believe, perpetrated by Mr. X, and we need your records to submit to the arbitrator as proof of that, the client may wonder why, the guardian may wonder what we're up to. I mean, there's no direct connection in those persons' view with our need to view the records, and yet we are hamstrung in the defense of the personnel action in the arbitration by not being able to provide direct evidence.
And the bill, as you're bringing it to us, proposes that, as regards to the mental health provisions of it, that these records would only be available when a patient or client has sued the state.
Mr. Chair, there are three instances where the bill would allow access by attorneys or claims adjusters from risk management, and those are to defend the state in an action brought by a patient where the patient has put at issue the care of the medical care or the care of the patient in the institution. Number two, attorneys would be allowed to look at the records without necessarily publicly disclosing them to investigate a claim.
I don't understand.
The bill allows investigation. Currently, if someone files a tort claim notice or an inmate files a claim against the Inmate Injury Fund, the risk management investigators or trial counsel can't go look at the record and determine whether the claim has any validity and if it indeed should be settled.
Mr. Chairman?
And the third instance?
The third instance is to support a personnel action taken against an employee or staff member of the Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Division where we suspect we're on the basis of patient abuse.
Well, if I'm a patient and I have been abused, or there's an allegation that I've been abused and a personnel action taken, I guess that one troubles me. I don't know why my records, why I should be subject to having my records opened up for a personnel action that is something that I've had nothing to do with, unlike filing a claim against the state. So, Representative Mannix, you had a question.
If I understand this situation correctly, someone tells you that they have a potential claim, or someone brings litigation against, say, the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division, or against the Department of Corrections. The people within that division or that department may look at their own records, but they have to be defended by the Department of Justice, and since the Department of Justice is a separate agency, people from the Department of Justice, the attorneys who are defending these people, can't look at those records. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, that's correct.
And that's where the scenario is different from, say, the private person who is sued, the doctor, who, because of the attorney-client relationship, can certainly have his or her own attorney come in and look over the records with the doctor and develop a defense. Or if they, so I understand now that the problem is this unique statutory scheme, and you're just asking to be basically similarly situated as any private attorney might be in assisting a client.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, that's correct.
Now, I have a couple more questions, if I may, about the amendments. Looks like I may. Let's go ahead here.
Yes.
Thank you. On page one of your proposed amendments, line three, you're saying to put this section in after the period on line 17, page one of the bill. Isn't this really a separate conceptual statement, and really shouldn't that be a separate subsection in here? I'm really asking you a format question. Was there any real need for it all to become a part of a 2A, which will then be almost one page long? Do you have any problem with us making it a separate subsection?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I do not.
Because when I was starting to read this in the context of the bill, we suddenly have a paragraph this long, and the first part of it really deals with the Department of Corrections and its record keeping, and doesn't, you know, the lines 10 through 17 of the bill. Page one. That all has to do with records and Department of Corrections, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden we jump into this exemption as to suits and proceedings and the like, which is a separate concept. And so you don't have a problem with us maybe putting that in a separate subsection?
No, I do not.
Follow-up on that is line 16 of your amendments. I always hate these double negative concepts. This isn't double negative language exactly, but it says, nothing in this subsection prohibits the inspection or release. Well, is someone going to look around in the rest of the law to look for something else that prohibits? Do you want us to say that we're authorizing inspection or release of written accounts to the Risk Management Division of the Department of General Services?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I think that is the intent.
So you wouldn't mind if we just said the Department of General Services Risk Management Division may, upon request, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. No problem?
I think that's better.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may address your concern, let me briefly give you, flesh out just real briefly why the records may become important in a labor arbitration relating to a personnel action. We had a true instance where an employee was charged with kicking a client, I believe at Fairview, in the groin, and the employee raised it as an excuse that the injury had really been caused by a kick that somebody else had delivered to the client earlier. And the in this instance, the client did give consent for use of the records in the arbitration. Now, the medical records were used for two reasons. They were used to establish that the nature of the injury which was treated was done shortly after the event, as seen by eyewitnesses, the event meaning the abuser's kick of the client. and the treatment records helped show that the injury was fresh based on the fact it was still swelling at the time of the treatment, so it couldn't have been the earlier kick that caused the problem. Second, the records were used to show that there was no report of the alleged kicking, one used as an excuse, even though these kinds of events are required to be reported at Fairview. So this helped discredit the testimony concerning the alleged earlier event. Now, we have heard some concerns with regard to that subsection in terms of restricting the access by the Department of Justice only to those records that are actually relevant to the abuse investigation itself or to the labor arbitration proceeding. And if it's not against your protocol to suggest a further amendment, I'd just like to say that we would not be opposed to further restricting that subsection so that it's clear, and this was just brought to my attention today, so that it's clear that the release for personnel actions is limited only to records relevant to the alleged action or inaction by the staff. And as I said, Ms. Raffel is here to give you further testimony with regard to the need that the Department of Justice has from Fairview's perspective with regard to the access to these records. My final point is that this does not change, expand, alter at all access by third parties. This only gives the state's lawyers access, and third-party access is still prohibited or limited under subsection 9 of the original statute. I'm still on the mental health and developmental disabilities side, so I'm referring to ORS 179.5059. So this is really just to give lawyers access. The lawyers' then use of the records in court would be limited by the provisions of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. We'd stand in the shoes just like any other attorney as to our use in court, and our use in contested cases would be limited by the provisions of the APA. So it's not give us the records and we'll give them to the newspapers. Give us the records and we'll use them like other lawyers do in the same and similar circumstances. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. President Parks.
Patient was out on the street in Salem, got hit by a car, sued the driver. Would the defendant driver's lawyer have access to the records to show what the physical condition was prior to the accident?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parks, the defendant's lawyer could access those records pursuant to the current provisions of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, which we think are overridden by the restrictive prohibitions in this statute. And we're just trying to take that away so we stand on even footing with the defendant's lawyer.
If I'm the driver's lawyer, I can get access. But if the patient falls out of the bed at the hospital and sues the state, then the state's lawyers can't get access to see what his physical condition was before?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parks, that is our reading of the statute.
If I do this correctly, my numbers are correct. Out of 1,000 hearings, approximately, there were 60 victims who attended. It was indicated to me that the numbers of victims who are requesting notification is increasing, and the committee will note that the first figure there is that they added in that same period of time 199 victims just to the tracking system. So I think that these numbers will continue to build. I would also note that these are not broken down by offense. I think there was some testimony that 20% of all sex offenders, of all felony offenses or sex offenses, I seem to recall that figure, but whether or not that matches with this group, there's no way of knowing at this point. But I thought it would be important to have numbers.
Thank you. When we left then, what we were waiting for, I think, was the proposal for some victim notification. As I take it, counsel, your memo to Virginia Vanderbilt asks her to draft the amendments that the committee adopted in conceptual form on Monday. Is that correct?
That's my understanding. Okay. I mean, it seems to me, okay, I'm recalling that.
So we don't need to revisit those issues, I don't think.
I don't believe so.
I think we've fought those battles and we're over that turf. So all that remains really is to decide whether and what we would like to do in terms of victim notification. Let me poll the committee here publicly for a minute. My understanding was, set aside the question of victim notification for a minute. My understanding was that when we left this issue on Monday, the committee was ready to go with the bill, and then the idea came up. So I'm still hoping to move the bill today with or without the victim notification section in it. So adding pressure to Representative Bell's presentation, tell us about Section 7.
I think we've made it very easy for you. I met with Major Renfro, and we talked about two approaches, the optimum and the realistic, and what you have before you is the realistic, which I think is still going a major step forward. This particular amendment is based...
Sections don't match.
Excuse me for a minute.
Sorry. Sections are all misnumbered.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. This particular approach puts the responsibility to find out the information on the victim themselves, rather than having the state track the victim's address and report to them on a regular basis. This establishes a toll-free number where the victim can call at any time to find out the county of residence of the offender. And I'm going to emphasize that word county because they're what we did discuss later, the importance of not giving out addresses because of the case of retribution,
right,
or that sort of thing, but county seemed to be the direction we would go. The victim would receive an ID number, which would get them access to the line, so that not just every person in the world could call in and get information, and they would be informed that any misuse of that ID number would cause them to lose the privilege of finding out this information, and thus protecting the offender's rights in a sense. We believe that the fiscal impact will be negligible. Major Renfro felt good about incorporating this into the program of the State Police Department.
Thank you very much, Representative Bell. I appreciate the work and the initiative. Mm-hmm. Council.
I just have one clarification and direction from the committee. On line 8 of Section 7, and the sections all don't match up, it says when a victim receives notification under 144, 127, those are the post-prison supervision notification requirements regarding notice of prospective release or at any other time. I couldn't, under the time constraints, come up with other times where logically that person might be notified. At a time of parole or at sentencing, there are probably other periods of time where if the committee wants to insert something specific to make that more broad than it is, then the committee should give some direction there. I just didn't have time today to find it. But 144 only is post-prison supervision. The registration bill does apply to parolees who are not going to be notified at that point. So I just, at this point, said at any other time, there may be points in the system that logically appear. I just wasn't finding them.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bell, were you finished?
Yes.
Okay.
Major Renfro, would like to add any.
Yes or no, you are comfortable with the proposal?
Chairman Clark, yes, I am comfortable with the proposal. There are a couple of things for clarification I'd like to mention, if I
sure.
could. One, other times might be, for example, like escape, walk away from incarceration, that type of thing, where victims would want to be notified just right offhand. That would be an instance. I think it would be relatively inexpensive to maintain a 1-800 toll-free number, and we would make that service available. I think that the identification number to the victims would have to be assigned early during the period, such as when the person's convicted, and perhaps assigned by the corrections, and then entered into the LEDS sex offender file, so that state police can access that. When we do have a telephone inquiry, we could access that through LEDS and determine what that identification number is, so that we can then be assured that who we're talking to is the
okay.
victim.
Good. Thank you very much. Representative Mannix.
Wouldn't it be best to assign the ID number to the victim when the LEDS entry is first being initiated, and then to advise the victim of the victim's rights under this provision when the victim is first receiving notification of release or, you know, kick in at any time, that there be some explanation of their rights. See what I mean?
Yes, Chairman Clark, Representative Mannix, that's correct. And I believe the initial entry into LEDs would be made by corrections, and that would be the appropriate time, in my opinion, to assign the ID number and to advise of the rights.
Well, may I follow up on that?
Sure.
My problem there would be corrections may not be communicating with the victim, whereas others may have, for instance, Board of Parole has to communicate with the victim. I was just thinking whenever there is a required communication to the victim initially, then the victim could be advised. I don't want to create another paper requirement here.
Mr. Fotz, could you comment
on the discussion
here?
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Vern Fotz. I chair the Board of Parole. And for both parolees and those persons under post-prison supervision, the board has a responsibility to communicate with them with respect to that offender, especially around release dates. For the parolee, of course, we have a lot of other issues, but we do have this requirement to communicate and to communicate with the victims if they so notify us of their interest.
Okay. Thank you. Sandy's for just a minute. Thank you. Further questions?
Representative Bell signaling something to me.
I was just wondering if Representative Mannix was writing in regards to the suggestion about making the ID number out earlier. So we have it in item 3.
I've made a note conceptually that we assign the ID number to the victim when the LEDs entry is first made.
Okay.
Second one is that whenever there's any notice given to the victim of the victim's rights, which has to be done right now under certain provisions, that they be advised of their rights under this provision also.
Right. Okay. Representative Bell moves her proposed amendments marked Section 7. And Representative Mannix has a proposed friendly amendment. How's that, right? Right. Which is?
That in regard to subsection 3 there, that we assign the ID number to the victim when the LEDs entry is first made, and that we advise the victim of the victim's rights under this section, this whole section, when the victim is first receiving formal notice of rights or of action in regard to the inmate, to the criminal.
Okay, before we discuss it, I'm going to make sure Representative Bell considers that a friendly amendment.
Yes, I do.
All right. Council has a comment, and then Representative Edmondson.
Representative Mass, with all due respect, upon conviction and entry into the registry, the defendant will be given an identification number, which upon request shall be released to the victim. So there is already a point at which,
that's the defendant.
Well, see, and the question is the defendant has, there needs to be some clarification about who's getting the identification number.
Both of them are.
Same numbers or different numbers?
No.
The defendant is given a number which the victim is entitled to have access to.
Right, and I see that as happening. That's what my intent was in lines 1 and 2. So as soon as you get convicted, and it's entered at the courtroom, the witness should be given the number.
Well, thank you. In fact, I appreciate the due respect. The point is that you didn't write that down even though you were thinking it because you just talked about the defendant getting an ID at that point.
Great.
I'm glad to know we're going to do the victim also, and that was the whole point. Let's give the victim the ID early on.
Right.
I think that.
No, we're not giving the victim a number. We are giving a victim access to the defendant's ID number.
So the defendant actually is given an ID number, which is then released to the victim.
Stop. Okay. Two ID numbers. Defendant gets an ID number to identify him as, this is bad guy number one. Victim has to have an ID number to access the toll-free line.
You can't get the defendant's name unless you've got the magic ID number. You can't call
so the
up
only,
and say,
the only
where's
people
Mannix?
Who would,
you've got to call up and say, where's
0357?
Right.
As I understand the proposal, the only way you could get into the system is the fact that you have the defendant's number.
Yeah.
And you call the 1-800 number, they ask you if you have the defendant's ID number, you give them the ID number, and no one but the victim is going to have that ID number.
It's the registration ID.
You can ask Major Renfro, but I thought you were going to have two ID numbers, one to identify the defendant, and he may have 10 victims out there, and a second one to identify the person who's calling in to show that they have access to the system. And that one person, one out of the 10 victims, may have done something wrong accessing the system and would be revoked as to their access, but 9 other victims didn't do anything wrong and shouldn't be revoked as to access. That's why I thought there would be.
Major Renfro is far too smart to get in the middle of a family feud, but we'll ask him if he has any comments about it.
Chairman Clark, I would prefer that there be a number specifically assigned to the victim and the convicted person. so that because there are multiple victims and occasionally there's multiple convicted suspects.
So I pick up the phone. How does this work then? I pick up the phone, and what do I say? I dial the 800 number.
1234, I'd like information on 678.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay.
Conceptually,
I got it.
All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Bell.
The nice thing about it is if it's done at the initial input on the computer, you'd have with the convicted person's information.
We love it.
All those numbers that are assigned.
We love it. Move it.
As Bill Walton used to say.
Yeah, move it.
All right. Further discussion about the proposed amendment and friendly amendment. Is there opposition to the friendly amendment to the amendment before we vote on the main amendment? No opposition to that. The friendly amendment is in. All right. Is there further discussion about the victim notification system as it has been amended and proposed? Is there opposition? Hearing none. Section 7, as amended, is adopted into the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
I move the bill as amended to the... We amended all the other amendments before.
Yes. Yes.
I believe that we have...
With the 10 years of conviction of all
Just to be doubly sure, I would remove all of those amendments that Holly Robinson has...
Representative Mannix moves the conceptual amendments on the memorandum to Virginia Vanderbilt from Holly Robinson dated February 19, 1991, numbers 1 through... 8. Is there objection to those amendments? So ordered. Representative Mannix moves.
I move the bill as amended to the full committee.
House Bill
2407,
as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion. Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Baumann?
Aye.
Representative Bell?
Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
Aye.
Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative Mason?
Aye.
Representative Parks?
Aye.
Representative Sinceri?
Aye.
Chair Clark?
Chair votes aye. The bill is passed to the full committee. And do I have a volunteer to carry? Representative Bell?
Yes.
Would you be willing to carry
aye.
That bill? With full support from the committee on the floor. I'm going to suggest full support from the committee if necessary on the floor, because it may be necessary. Thank you, committee. Any further business come before the committee? If not, we are adjourned.